accession number 22359, wheel 2.
Robert Taylor, reel 2. What about living conditions?
The living conditions of the Reading Show were not so bad for the Brits, because we had a little room of our own, which was called the British Mess, and it was very, very small for at the most 8 people and sometimes 6. And there we were, all cramped in this little room. We just had enough room to sleep and eat, and our lockers, and that was it. There was no other room to move about. And outside, well, it stank. Because my leading seaman, who was in charge of our mess, insisted that whatever the weather, we scrubbed the floors and cleaned everything with water. And it smelt beautiful. But the French only did it about once a month. What was the wine being spilt everywhere? Right. Which they had all day. What was the wine being spilt everywhere? Stained and everything. And lots of other things. When you went from the British mess through to go on duty, you had to go through the French messes to go upstairs. Like, oh, sickening. Sickening. Especially during bad weather, when people really weren't washing and that sort of thing. We had a bathroom, the after size of this room, for everyone on board, apart from the officers, which was about 80 men. And we had to wash in there. And before you had a wash, you used to have to go, each man had to go and pump on this big pump like this until you felt the pressure. And then the chap in the bathroom would say, "All right, okay," and you'd stop. And I did it, my turn, I pumped. And I went into the bathroom, and these Frenchmen said, "Go and pump, can't come in here with it." So somebody, another Frenchman, yelled, "He's just done it!" And it's the sort of thing you've got to contend with. And the food, well, it was so bad that at the end of a convoy, which lasted 16 days, we had to go to the nearest Nathy, wherever it was, or whatever they called it where we were, a Yankee PX or something. We had to go and eat. Oh, ask for the biggest meals and eat it till we, and then we felt all right. So then what we did was, the French sailor on board who was responsible for the food, he used to get us about 200 tins of sardines, all piled up in the locker. 200 tins of sardines, Portuguese sardines, I remember. How they got them, I don't know, during the war. I really don't know. They used to have stacks of them. And we used to get bread. We were all right for bread, because we used to bake the bread. We used to get the bread and slap the sardines in between and eat them, just to put, because we were hungry. Because the French cooks, well, they used to overcook everything, overcook. Don't talk to me about French cuisine, because it was non-existent on that ship. And then you got cabbage, which was bled white. You had potatoes that were mashed, were filled with water. You had wine poured over it, whether you wanted it or not. And that was your dinner. Well, for 2 years I lived like that. Starving, nearly. Well, not starving, because we... That's it.
Could you get anything like fresh fruit?
No, not unless you went and bought it the other side, or took it from England. It soon went, though. I mean, 16 days, you soon got rid of it. You waited till you got ashore over in Canada or America, and filled up with everything that you could. Hershey bars, chocolates, wow. You should see what that chap who was in charge of the food got for us. You opened the door, and there was Hershey bars, chocolate bars, filled right up like that. And he used to charge so much for them. And we used to get maybe 5 or 6 Hershey bars and make them last and take them on watch with you and eat them. But the greatest thing about it, of course, was the cocoa. which we used to make ever so strong, really strong cocoa, until it was until your spoon almost stood up in it, plenty of sugar. Well, that was a meal, especially at night on the bridge. Twice during the night you had Kai brought up to you, steaming hot. Sometimes I had to go down and make it. And I would inadvertently break the bar in half and put some in my pocket. I don't think anyone ever found out.
Why did you drink cocoa rather than tea or coffee?
Because that's navy, isn't it? That is navy, whether it's French or... Well, I don't know whether it's French, but that was a navy. And downstairs they had one of these things like that that was bubbling away. And you could make your cocoa like that. I only made it for the officer to watch, and the signalman, and the chap in the ASDIC bloke who was listening for contacts.
And the crew drank a lot of wine?
The French did, we didn't. Oh no, horrible stuff. And I drink wine every night with a wife. But there's no comparison. It was Pinard, was called. And it was because it was given to the French Navy in barrels and barrels, it was naturally cheap. Absolute rubbish. But they used to drink it. They used to offer it to us. I tried it. Couldn't drink it. It's like vinegar. Yeah, that's right. It was just like vinegar.
And Pinard was the brand name?
I don't know whether it was a brand name or whether it was just the name of the one, you know, made. But that's what they called it.
Were any spirits drunk?
Yes, we had rum. Purely for the British. Purely for the British.
Did you take that?
No, I was underage. When I got to the age of 18, they said, do you want to participate in the rum ration or take your threepence a day? And I said, I'll take the threepence a day.
What did you spend that on?
Well, threepence a day was quite a lot of money. It enabled you to probably, wherever you were, enabled you to have a small meal. Far better in my pocket than drinking rum. Never liked spirits anyway, apart from brandy. And I couldn't afford brandy, so...
Did anybody drink excessive alcohol aboard?
Yes. On my 19th birthday, when I'd been on this ship for 18 months, on my 19th birthday, my friends in the British liaison, the six of them, plied me with drink, patted me on the back and all that sort of thing, and had a party and everything, and I became unconscious. And that's the first time. And they got so worried, because they couldn't revive me, that they just had to send for the British Naval officer and admit what they'd done. They just had to, because I could have paid eight there and then. But they brought me round. And that's the only time that's ever happened to me. And I've, ever since in the Navy, my 39 years in the Navy, I've very rarely drunk. I've had a drink, but never stayed in a pub and drunk up and have another and all that. Never. Wasn't a teetotal, but I was never drunk again. Not like that.
During the war, when you were in this friendship, what was your state of health like?
I was good. 17, 18 years of age. No problems. The others had different little problems, but I was problem-free where health was concerned.
You were telling me about preparing for D-Day.
Oh, yeah.
When you were training with the American forces.
Yes.
Whereabouts was that?
Up off Elsie Craig, you know? round about Elsie Craig, up and down around Elsie Craig, Stranraer and all round there.
Can you tell me what happened as in the build up to D-Day to you?
Yes, I can. Very much so. To me, personally. Yes, my wife knows about this. I was on the bridge. You know how the platforms for the ceiling projectors where you stand come out over the ship. Right, there's the ship, and then either side, the ceiling projectors come over the sea a bit, don't they? For you to stand on, right? I can remember this. I'm standing on the starboard platform with my light, and I'm watching what's going on. This is no lie, Conrad. Honestly, the things I'm telling you are true. And a sea fire from a British Spitfire. Well, there was lots of them, and they all came down and they fired cannons that missed the ship intentionally, but were training, right? Training. And this particular Spitfire came down the side of the ship. Very low, with cannons firing, and it went right underneath my platform. You know, and it takes a sort of a split second for him to be misguided at that speed. Then, well, I shouted, "You so and so!" I won't say the words. It really shook me, that did. Within moments I got over at that age. It didn't affect me. But it was a terrific shock to have cannons go into the sea about that far from the ship. And I'm standing like this over it, and it's gone underneath.
Just a few inches away.
Yeah. But anyway, the build-up to D-Day, after we'd finished it, we went down to Plymouth, right? Where everything was massed. The Americans in their thousands were all massed with landing craft, tanks, everything. They were all there already by their thousands. And we couldn't get into Plymouth, really. It was so packed out. You'll never believe it. Plymouth, a great big naval base, was packed out. So we went to ferry, that little ferry in Cornwall. And we went up the river to ferry and anchored right in the middle, opposite the little town of Ferry, and waited instructions. And then we had to go back to Plymouth about the 4th of June. And because D-Day was originally for the 5th of June, we were sent to Torbay, and then we went into the convoy, and then we were told, stop, everyone resume in positions that you were. So we all went back, the American soldiers come off, and then it was the 6th of June, it was to be tomorrow, the 6th of June, right, so off we went. Well, then we went off, joined the big convoy, and there was hundreds of little convoys all coming out from different ports of England. There were things coming out from Torquay, there were things coming out from Falmouth, there was the big ones coming out from Portsmouth and Southampton. All hundreds of ships laden with men and soldiers, all coming out from the various ports of England, with the attendant navy there, like us, corvettes, destroyers, the big battleships, the monitors, which were with us, the big monitors, which were sort of ships with great big guns. And we all formed up at Piccadilly Circus, which was the name for the Isle of Wight meeting, where we all stayed overnight. And Piccadilly Circus, you couldn't see the sea hardly for miles. It was just packed with ships. And then over the channel we went, straight across towards Normandy. We arrived at 6:30 in Utah Beach, because we were the Yanks, of course. So we had to go to either Omaha Utah, or Utah. Well, ours was Utah. And we got there, and the bombardment had just started, about 6 o'clock. And what a sight it was. That's all I can say. So I've never seen it in my life before. I've never, ever seen an invasion fleet, ever. And that one just took my breath away. The sound and everything, and the landing craft going in, and the monitors were alongside us, and the sound of their guns was something chronic. Oh, terrific. The Erebus was one. You know the Erebus, the monitor? The Erebus. The New Zealand ship, the Black Prince, that was alongside us. Can't remember them now. I did at the time. I remembered all their names. But that was it. That was D-Day. I mean, D-Day only lasted really the 6th of June. You know, I mean, and that was it. They were all ashore, and poor people on Omaha next to us were shattered up, smashed to bits. But we had it easy. Utah had it easy. Now, we were... Utah was the last one. And we were right on the extreme edge. Right on the extreme edge, but there was nothing else. Right? Which would have been the west, facing Normandy. We were right on the extreme edge, and we were doing anti-submarine patrols, guarding the Americans at Utah.
Did you detect any submarines?
No. Because apparently there weren't any in the area.
Was there any incoming fire from the shore against you?
Yeah. Pathetic, really. I remember looking through my telescope and seeing the effect of the naval bombardment and the churches being blown up, just disappearing in a puff of smoke. Must have been terrible for the French people in those villages. The buildings that were going up in flames and smoke were really terrible. That had to be done, didn't it?
How did the French crew of your ship feel about D-Day, what was happening?
Well, they knew it had to be, and they wanted to get it over as fast as possible. And they wanted de Gaulle to enter Paris as fast as possible. And so, although it must have been terrible for them to see their own country being blasted to blazes, I think they realised that it just had to be in order to free France. After all, they were free Frenchmen.
Did they ever say anything to you about the Vichy regime or General de Gaulle?
Yeah. Yes. We had some Vichy sailors. I don't know how they got there. We had some Vichy sailors who had been in the French fleet at Mers El Kabir, but it was destroyed by the Brits. Well, they did hate us. And I don't know how they came to be in the Free French Navy, whether they reneged on the Vichy or what. I don't know how they got away to join. But they were there. There were about 3 of them. And they had been at Mers El Kabir. They didn't speak to us. Ignored us completely. Really ignored us. I suppose you could blame them. Their navy was destroyed so that it wouldn't fall into the hands of the Germans.
What about the other free French sailors? Did they say anything about the Vichy regime?
Yes. When I was talking to them privately, they didn't think much of them. They treated them as enemy. I really don't know how those 3 men got on board a free French ship when they had been at Mers El Kabir and had been under... I just don't understand it. Must have been some reason. Well, there is a couple of things if I've got time, have I?
Yes, please.
Going back to my first convoy in 1943... we were told that we had a secret mission to accomplish, that we were not to speak about it. And we went by night to this little island by Saint-Pierre Miquelon. And it was French, of course, wasn't it, Saint-Pierre? And just off Canada. And at dead of night, six French sailors armed with rifles, gaiters and bayonets went off. Came back a few minutes later with a chap, a little man, dark hair and a moustache. Looked a bit like Laval, you know, looked a bit like him. Anyway, apparently he was the mayor of that island, particular French island, who had betrayed them to the Germans, or was going to, in the hope of a German victory at the Battle of Britain, an invasion, all set for the Americans sort of thing. And he was a traitor, and he was brought back for execution. And the 16 days that were at sea coming back to Britain, he used to stand like this, like Napoleon, looking out over the water, very, very unhappy. But because he was a mayor, they treated him like an officer, and they brought him coffee and biscuits up, and he had a cabin, and he was treated just like a naval officer. But when we got to Greenock, he was roughly taken down, and once again, about six free French sailors with bayonets took him and put him into a van, and off they went. Now, I have tried and tried and tried from all angles to find out whether he was executed or what. And everyone's kept mum. The French have kept mum. I can't understand what's happened. I've asked other people who were on board at the time. Don't know. So secret.
So he used to stand on the deck with his hands clasped behind his back?
Yes, look at it. He would talk to the officers. They would talk to him. Not conversation-wise, but just something or other. I don't know what it was. And he was allowed up there for about an hour and then taken down. You wouldn't see him again till maybe the next day. Then he'd be allowed up on deck for an hour. Just on the bridge, nowhere else. He couldn't converse with any of the French sailors. Absolutely out of it. They couldn't, not to talk to him. We couldn't talk to him, not allowed to. Only the officer on the bridge was allowed to talk to him. And then he was taken down again. Execution, I just don't know. He was to be executed, I know. But whether he was life or what, so secretive. I only wish we knew.
Was anybody else taken from the islands?
No, just him.
Any other incidents you remember?
Yes, I do. Something pretty bad. A week before D-Day, and we didn't know, of course, that it was going to be D-Day. We didn't even know the date. All we knew was it was building up to something very rapid. We were in Plymouth, and I went into the chart room on the bridge. It's not very big, it's about the size of our toilet. And there's a little table there, and the confidential books are normally kept there at sea. But, of course, in harbour, they're locked away. And there's this big book on the table. And it says, Honest Truth. There's this big book on the table. And this was about the 31st of May, I remember, 1944. And I was on duty on the bridge. I was cleaning it up and making it nice and everything. Cleaning me lights on the thing. And I thought, what's this book doing here? Naturally, because it shouldn't be there. It should be away, locked away. And when I opened it, I managed to get it open. And there on the flyleaf was the words, Operation Neptune. I thought, Operation Neptune, never heard of it. What's that then? Well, there's nobody about. Nobody about. We were in harbour. People were ashore. Nobody on the bridge. Just me. And as I turned the pages, it said things like, it has anticipated that Paris would fall, so and so and so and so. Well, I just shut the book like that. I thought, I should not be reading this, and that book should not be there. There's Doc Yardman who come on board, There could be anybody. Anybody at all should come on board and read that bloody book. And it shouldn't be there. It should be locked away. Because I realised what it was about. I didn't read on. I just shut the book, but I did see a few paragraphs. And it was all about the invasion of Normandy. Well, I saw my leading hand and I said, do you know what I've just seen? What, he says. I told him. He said, well, you keep your trap absolutely shut. You keep it shut and you say nothing. Is that understood? And I said, yes, Hooky, yes, I understand. And I've kept it shut until after the war, when I was telling people and various people like that. Who was responsible? I don't know. Some idiot must have been. Don't you agree?
Yes. Where did you find the book?
On the table in the chart room. See, each corvette's got a little chart room on the bridge. And where people can get, if the weather is really foul and they're not really required, if there's convoys quiet and we're just ambling along and things like that, and it's pouring with rain, you just get under there with the canopy down and wait for it to ease off. See? Well, in harbour, my job was to keep it clean, stow the books away, make it look nice for any visitors on board, any British people, we come on board, see us, think, well, that's nice, it's a nice, well-kept ship, and clean the lights, where, you know, the single projectors, and that sort of thing. That was my job in harbour, because there was no sort of work at convoys, and that was when I found the book. In full view of everybody who happened to walk in that little chart room. It's only a little chart room like that, with a big canvas flap over it. And you went in, and there's a table like this, and various things for you to do during rough weather. And it's got a little light on it. And that, well, I couldn't believe that there was, but it must have been an officer, because only he's got access to that book. And the book being what it is at that particular day, I just couldn't believe that this was happening to me. You know how you felt.
Could it have been a deliberate act of sabotage?
No, I think just someone left it out, forgot about it, was reading it and left it out and didn't put it away. Maybe called away. Maybe called away, left the book there. I came in, looked at it. Operation Neptune, what's that all about? Turned the pages and was horrified at what I saw was something in the future. I mean, I foresaw, really, Normandy in all its glory a week before it happened. I thought it was absolutely appalling. I just really thought it was appalling.
And this was in Plymouth?
That was in Plymouth, yeah. Absolutely maddening. Not being able to complain about it. Well, to be told, keep quiet about it. Don't say anything. We'll put you in the car if we hear that you've said anything. I didn't say a word. Kept it all to myself until after the war.
Any other incidents you remember?
That's really about it.
What is this signal projector? A signal projector, what exactly is it?
A signal projector? You've seen them during the war films, have you? Where the sailor has been flashing lights on a big round signal projector. It's about that big. Right. It's got a bulb in it and a metal backing that reflects. And when you switch on, there's the switch was down here by the guardrails. Switch on by pulling it down and switch off by pulling it up. And when you switch on, the light comes on. And it's got shutters on it, right? It's got shutters. And by just doing this on the little handle on the side, you can open the shutters and shut them quickly. And so you can do Morse light. And that's how you see the flashing lights that the fleet do at sea. Like A, dot dash, dot B, dash, dot, 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 that sort of thing. And make words and pass messages. Because all that's finished now. No such thing.
So were you on this...